Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Zeke. This is Movement Museum. It's December 30th. It's about 2:08 in the afternoon, and this is the radio show on CKUT 90.3 FM, where we talk about dance on your radio, and we talk to dancers and everything like that, and just have a grand old time. But before we do anything, we got a poem for you. This is called Pavlova in London, and it's by James Elroy Flecker. I listened to the hunger-hearted clown, sadder than he. I heard a woman sing, a tall, dark woman in a scarlet gown, and saw those golden toys the jugglers fling. I found a tawdry room, and there sat I, there angled for each murmur soft and strange. The pavement cries from darkness and below. I watched the drinkers laugh, the lovers sigh, and thought how little all the world would change if clowns were audience and we the show. What starry music are they playing now? What dancing is this dreary theater? Who is she with the moon up upon her brow? And who the firefoot god that follows her? Follows among those unbelieved-in trees, back shadowing in their parody of light across the little cardboard balustrade. And we, like that poor fawn who pipes and flees, adore their beauty, hate it for too bright, and tremble half in rapture, half afraid. Play on, O furtive and heartbroken fawn! What is your thin, dull pipe for such as they? I know you blinded by the least white dawn, and dare you face their quick and quivering day. Dare you, like us, weak but undaunted men, reliant on some deathless spark in you, turn your dull eyes to what the gods desire. Touch the light finger of your goddess. Then, after a second's flash of golden blue, drunken with that divinity, expire? Oh, dance, Diana, dance, Endymion, till calm ancestral shadows lay their hands gently across mine eyes. In days long gone, have I not danced with gods in garden lands? I too, a wild, unsighted atom born, deep in the heart of some heroic boy, span in the dance 10,000 years ago. And while his young eyes glittered in the morn, something of me felt something of his joy, and longed to rule a body and to know. Singer long dead and sweeter lip than I, in whose proud line the soul dark phrases burn. Would you could praise their passionate symmetry, who love the colder shapes, the attic urn. But your far song, my faint one, what are they? And what their dance in fairy thoughts and hours, or night abloom with splendid stars and pale? 'Tis an old story that sweet flowers decay, and dreams the noblest die as soon as flowers, and dancers, all the world of them, must fail. And that's called, yeah, Pavlova in London by James Elroy Flecker. We got a couple of things for you. We got an interview with Lourdes Lopez, who used to dance with the New York City Ballet. And then we got an interview with from 1986 with Lucas Hovig, who used to dance with Jose Limon. And I think we're going to start with Lucas Hovig. So here goes.
Hello, I'm Billy Mahoney, and this is Dance On. Dance On is a show about people who dance. And we invite you to sit in on our conversations with these people who dance. Now, actually, this is the first show I've done here in New York City in almost a year, not quite, but almost a year. And I've been out in California teaching at Stanford University for this past year. In fact, if you're watching the show here in New York City, probably the last few shows you've seen were those that we've taped at Stanford University. And now we're back in New York, and I wasn't too sure I was going to be happy coming back to New York, but I love it. Because on the way back, I traveled through all those canyons, Bryce Canyon, Zion Canyon, Grand Canyon, and I thought, how am I going to feel about those canyons of New York City? And like they said out there, you have to get down into the canyons to really appreciate it. Like I rode a mule down into the canyon, and it was wonderful down there in the quiet of the canyon. But you've got to get deep inside it to really understand it and appreciate it, and that's New York City too. So I'm very happy to be back. And we've got a wonderful guest. I've sort of We've chased each other. Well, I don't think he's chased me, but I sure have chased him to get him on the show. We were at Bennington College last summer, and we tried to tape a show there, which didn't work out. He was to be my guest in San Francisco and at Stanford University, and he had to take off and leave town all at once. But we've got him here today in New York City, and I want you to meet him right now, Lucas Hoving. Lucas, come join us. And I am so pleased and happy that you are here and that I finally got you sitting on a stool opposite me on Dance On. Lucas, for our viewers, Lucas Hoving is one of those, well, I don't know, pioneers or second generation pioneer of modern dance. And the dancers today hold him in great awe and respect. And they are so thrilled if they can get him to come in to be artistic consultant for their companies and to work with what they're doing. And Lucas danced with Jose Limon for many, many years. And in fact, the Jose Limon Dance Company was with Lucas Hoving. I don't think we saw when Jose was performing, we didn't see him without you.
At the very end
of his life and period,
right.
Yeah. 63 was my last year.
Yeah.
Well, performing. I still worked as company, as rehearsal director.
Right.
But 48 till 63, I did my only things with him.
Lucas, I saw at Bennington College, because I always start the show, where are you from, and tell us something about your background. But now, you are performing now, you still perform now.
Oh, yeah.
And you do a piece called Growing Up in Public that tells about you, that Remy Charlotte, that he directed for you.
And conceived, thought of, conceived and directed, you say.
How did that come about? How was the piece designed?
Well, originally it started because Remy had read way back, it's a long time ago, in Dance Perspectives. They had once a whole issue on sort of the second rank, choreographers. Not Graham, not Limon, not, Russ Cunningham, but it was Remy and myself, Danny Negrin, Mary Lewis, I believe it was seven of us.
Uh-huh.
And we all had articles that we wrote, mine with the help of Marcia Siegel.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of pulled that out of me. And I had talked about my life in there a little bit. I had mentioned that as a dancer, or even more, as a dancer and choreographer, you really grow up in public because you're giving a performance and the next day you read in the paper how far you're along, that's how the title came about, and this gave Remy the idea of writing this monologue for me.
Now, how did he get the information?
Well, we sat and talked for hours.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, not really all that long. And he'd say, all right, tell me about a certain part of your life, and I started to tell, and then next day he'd said, do it again, and then maybe I had said it a little differently, and then he remembers. He's incredible.
Well, did he do sort of a questionnaire, though?
He also sent me a questionnaire. With all these things about my life that I had to fill.
Right, about your mother
It's
a very interesting piece. So you were born where? Where are you from?
In Holland, northeast Holland, Groningen.
Where?
Groningen.
All right.
Groningen.
Oh, okay. I've been there, it seems I've seen that in print. All right, did you dance in Holland?
Oh, yes. Very early, and so far that I was a sort of child prodigy on the piano.
Oh, on the piano.
And then I was 13, a woman in our town had gone to study modern dance in Berlin, if it was Berlin, I forget, in Germany anyway, it was Mary Wigman. And when she came back to town, she opened her own school, and she needed a pianist, so I got that was it. And as a man, you could not study dance as a boy. You couldn't study dance there. Later on, I had some tap classes. But dancing, well, it wasn't even called dancing. It was called rhythmic gymnastics.
Rhythmic gymnastics,
And
now, why was it that you could not study dance?
There were clubs for women.
The classes were only for women.
Yeah. And there was no other opportunity. It was not that big a town. Mm-hmm. I'm talking 1925 at the mm-hmm. moment, you know, when I was 13.
Uh-huh.
And so that was early. And but from playing for these classes and saying maybe three times a night, it was usually late afternoon, early evening classes, a couple of days a week. Well, I saw the warm-ups and I saw the things, so I practiced it all at home.
Ah.
And that is how I got to discover that I kind of liked to move.
I see.
I thought I wanted to be an actor, mm-hmm. really. But my parents thought, well, piano is sort of, you know, as far as they wanted to go out on a limb on that.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, I studied piano and oboe because the teacher that I had was an oboist in our local symphony orchestra, and he gave piano lessons, and my parents probably thought of it, you know, it was as good a way to make a living as any of those.
So then, when did you really get serious about dance, though?
At a certain point, I knew that I had to get out of Groningen, and I went to Amsterdam,
mm-hmm.
where it's a different story. You know, that's a very much more cosmopolitan town, and I had to get a little job to make my living, but I managed to play for schools in dancing schools there, and then either I got paid or I play for a class and take a class.
Uh-huh.
And that went on for a couple of years, and pretty soon I managed to get sort of club dates. There was a girl I played also for tap dance, the school for tap dance, and the daughter of the lady who ran it, and I got sort of act together, and that was my first quite professional work. We went out to club dates.
Did you tap dance?
I tap danced, sure.
Uh-huh.
And we had a little sort of act.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And then one thing led to another, and I kept studying more, and then at a certain point we got into a show, and at a certain point Yvonne Georgi, I don't know if you know, the partner of Harold Kreutzberg, mm-hmm. she had married a Dutch guy, and she had what is now the National Ballet, but then it was a group that was part of the Wagner Society, and she had a company there, and then at one point she asked me to come and dance with her.
Uh-huh.
And I immediately danced with her as a partner. It says, you know.
Now what kind of dance was this?
We did
Oops.
Hold it.
You all right?
Come on, Salome and Herodes.
Oh.
We did a duet. Uh-huh. We did some Hungarian dances, Brahms music.
Uh-huh.
We did together, believe it or not, the fire, the three-cornered hat.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know Spanish,
yeah.
but I had tap danced, and
right.
I could use my feet and dance.
Uh-huh. And a presence.
And then we did more things together.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And from that, then somebody said, okay, and I got already a job. You know, you had to work in sort of clubs, nightclubs, or in movie
uh-huh.
houses.
Yeah.
And I got with some sort of unit that toured France, Belgium. We played in movie houses. And at a certain point, there was a Dutch dancer in the Joost Ballet, and he came and said, you should audition for Joost. You should get out of Holland. And so I went to audition for Joost,
uh-huh.
and then he gave me a full scholarship, room and board and
Wonderful.
Everything. And so, and then the war broke out. I was still in the school, 38, and some of the German dancers left the company. They didn't want to be in an enemy country,
mm-hmm.
you know. And the Joost Ballet had to go on tour, so I was picked out of the school, and that was it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, Joost, some of the people may not understand. It's Kurt Joost.
Kurt Joost, J-O-O-S-S,
yeah.
The Green Table.
Right, the Green Table, the big city.
Yeah.
People know
that.
Uh-huh. Yeah. A lot of people see the name in print and don't understand the pronunciation, but it's J-O-O-S-S, Kurt Joost. That's wonderful. Did you ever dance in the Green Table?
Oh, my God, hundreds of times. I mean, I was really, I suppose so. I was only really 3 years in the company.
Uh-huh.
39, 40, 41, maybe not even 3 years, but we, you know, that company toured constantly.
Uh-huh.
And very often, if we did particular one-night stands, it was always program number one, which had the Green Table at the end.
Uh-huh.
And very often it was one-night stands, so that was, I don't know. Surely.
Was Sigurd later with the company?
He was not in the company. He was the director of the school in Darlington Hall.
I see.
Fabulous teacher.
Uh-huh.
Fabulous.
Yes.
That year and a half, it's about all I was in school. That was, you know, he, oh, the whole school was beautiful.
Right.
Fabulous.
Right.
Beautiful people. But he was director of the school.
Uh-huh. It would be fun to talk more about that, but let's go on about what you did after that. Then how did you get to the States?
We were in the States when with the Yost Ballet, uh-huh, touring, and that was the beginning of the war. First, mm-hmm, we did Great Britain and, you know, England, Scotland, Ireland, and all that. Then we went to the States and America, Cuba. And then we went to South America. Mm-hmm. And then when we opened there that night, that day, Holland was invaded by Germany. Oh. And when we read the reviews, we went to look at the reviews and I saw the headlines, and then, yeah, I decided I have to get back to Holland. I don't know, it was a crazy idea, but I had, yeah, to go back.
Right.
I could not, you know, sort of, but I was in South America, was on the contract with Yost Bell, so it took me quite a while. And then came back to the States. I actually was here still a year dancing, and that's when I danced with Graham. I did really two Broadway shows. Because as an alien, I could not join the army. I had to wait till I was called up.
Oh.
However, just before that, I heard from people, I met some Dutch people, they said, but there's a Dutch exile army you can join. So I did that. And I don't know, I wanted to be in the Navy. But I joined the Dutch army, and, you know, I came back home with all my limbs. So sometimes I think maybe, you know, a pity that I didn't get into the American army, but, you know, I came home with all my, uh-huh, limbs together. So, and it was 4 years.
You were four years in the service, the,
yeah,
Dutch army.
Through, uh-huh, Europe, the whole European,
yeah,
campaign.
How did that affect your dancing? I mean, did you go directly back to dance after the service?
Yeah.
Were you able to do any dance
Not at all. But I had incredible luck, actually, again. Okay, I've had a lot of luck in my life, so I shouldn't touch it. But I was once, already when the war was over, I was on leave in England, and Agnes DeMille was doing a movie there. And, you know, Agnes had, when Yost got interned during the war, and we needed new repertoire, because we played long Broadway seasons also,
uh-huh,
and not long, 9 weeks or something.
Yeah.
And we needed repertoire, so Agnes did a piece for us. And I had a lead in that, and Agnes sometimes, in those days, said, loved to perform herself. She was a wonderful performer.
Uh-huh.
So then I danced with her, so we had to work a lot and get the lifts and everything straight. So then after the war, when I went to say hello to her, it was very funny. There was, the lead of that movie was a very tall English woman, Kay Kendall. She,
uh-huh,
was married to Rex Harrison, tall.
Right, right.
She,
uh-huh,
died sort,
uh-huh,
of very early. But, and I walked in there, and Agnes looked at me, some in uniform, and she said, "My God, the answer to a maiden's prayer, do you want a job?" And I walked right from the army. Overnight, they got Dr. J rank. Well, the war was over.
Uh-huh.
You know, we did interpreting work. I was communications.
Uh-huh.
You know, we all spoke four or five languages, that
right,
bunch that I was with.
Uh-huh.
So, from the one day to the next, I'm in the sergeant of the army. Next day, I'm the, you know, lead in the movie with a stand-in and a dresser and all that. Fabulous, yeah, in 2 months or something.
Wow.
Unfortunately, the movie was not the success. Yeah,
but you got paid anyway.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Lucas, let me ask you something. I, you know, teaching at the Juilliard School the last 15 years, and my background is variety. Like what you've been describing, your early background was variety, and then Broadway.
What do you mean variety? Vaudeville?
Yeah.
Varieté, they say.
Mm-hmm. What do you call it?
Varieté, the French.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know variety meant here the same thing.
Yeah, right.
Variety,
right,
show.
Uh-huh.
I never knew that.
Variety, because vaudeville was those eight straight acts, but variety was song and dance and,
oh,
and
oh,
that sort,
gee,
of thing.
I didn't know that.
And clubs and,
yeah,
all,
yeah,
all sorts,
yeah, yeah,
of variety,
yeah,
performances.
Yeah.
Which are not the serious, which is not serious,
yeah, yeah,
concert,
sure,
stage.
Sure.
And I found that a lot of people of your caliber today, who were the great modern dancers on the concert stage, have that kind of background. And I think a lot of the young people today think they can't do that. They have to go right into serious dance.
I know.
Do you think there's an advantage to having that kind of background?
Of course there's an advantage. I would have missed it for anything. I did the Roxy, four,
uh-huh,
shows a day,
yeah,
five on Sunday,
right,
five Saturday, Sunday.
Uh-huh.
You get, I mean, it is your training as a performer, and we are performers.
Yeah.
And you get so that your whatever stage and all the touring we did nightclubs, Vinnie Knight did nightclubs, you mm-hmm. know, we had a nightclub act.
Yeah.
Because you had to make a living, and you know, better than
that,
than
go and wait and say,
sometimes three. You have
yes.
to hang around till the to see
you
if
you have to perform sometimes for white tablecloths.
Oh sure,
empty clubs.
Piece of chicken in the hand.
Empty clubs, but with no audience out there.
Yeah.
One table, you have to go out and perform regardless.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's tremendous discipline.
Yeah.
And you learn to perform and dance.
Yeah, I suppose so. I suppose so. I mean, you feel it's your profession.
More. Yeah.
And then if you get onto a concert stage, it is a privilege.
Yes.
That's what I always
yes.
think.
Right. Well, you've paid your dues.
I
call all that variety paying
right.
your dues,
yeah.
and then you get to.
And you get to then to really, the,
right.
Dancing yeah. for whatever we dance for. Yeah, sure.
Okay. Now we pay our dues. Let's get to Jose. When did you first start dancing with Jose, or how did that come about?
Okay, after the war, when I got back here, and then Agnes brought me to this country for Bloomergirl to take mm-hmm. over the lead in Bloomergirl, and I was barely out of shape. And I went to ballet class sometimes twice a day because I wanted to quickly get my uh-huh. strength back. And Jose was in one of the ballet classes with Nanette Jurys. And so we sort of, cased each other. We didn't really know each other. Personally,
he's tall,
but we had
both
seen each other dance.
Mm-hmm.
I'd seen him perform, and he had seen me perform already uh-huh. in your spell. So one day I saw the opening, the very first performance of that, what later was the Limon Company in 48. I think it's 48. Doris did the premieres of art and of the Lament. Lament for
yes.
the Bullfighter,
mm-hmm.
Day on Earth. And then in the dressing room, for the first time, we talked, and I said to him, I saw your performance the very next day. Yes, I loved it. And then he said, well, I saw you performed a couple of weeks ago. I was just these choreographer's workshop things.
Uh-huh.
And so that we got to talk. And the next day he said, would you be interested in doing a dance with me?
Wow.
And that was La Malinche.
La Malinche. With
and
Pauline Kohner?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Wonderful.
Yeah. And then after
what year was that?
48.
1948. Uh-huh. And then the next year, one of the great masterpieces he
choreographed.
Moore's Pavane.
Yeah.
So you were a part of
oh, yes.
the creation of
yeah.
that. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Pauline Kohner sat here on the show and told about when she got her costume. You and she danced together.
Yeah.
And she got her costume, this heavy velvet dress, the skirt went clear across the stage, and that you had to work and work to
no,
overcome
it,
how
it
to
wasn't
move
all
that.
That big, but I mean, we had to, get that out of the way,
uh-huh.
because you step on that and you fall, but so that was, and we got the costumes, I suppose, the day before, because I remember the night of the, before the performance, the company was doing other piece that night, but Conan and I went to that old gymnasium they had there.
At Connecticut
yeah,
College.
That later became a bookstore. And there we worked and got all the tricks so that she could take it away and,
mm-hmm.
because when you have to do a lift, you got to be close to each other.
Right.
So you couldn't be on that skirt.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's one of those things that you have to learn, deal
yeah,
with.
You have to deal with that. Lucas, I just reconstructed from the Laban Notation score, There Is a Time, Jose
yeah.
Limon's work
yeah.
out at Stanford University.
Yeah.
And one of the pieces, well, back when Jose was still alive and I was rehearsal director for the company, I had asked him about one of the dances that I wasn't too happy the way it was being performed. And it's There Is a Time to Speak and Time to Be Silent.
Yeah.
And I had asked him, what's it mean because the silent, and that was during the period, this was in the early 70s when women were rebelling and it was like the woman was really muzzled in this
no,
dance.
But
and that bothered me. That bothered me and I didn't think it was being danced right. And I asked Jose, I said, What does it mean? And he said very simply, there's a time to speak and there's a time not to speak. And that's all there is to it. It's all there is to it, and that was all there was to it. So I'm
yeah, but wasn't this much earlier than the 70s?
Well, no, this is when I was directing the company.
Because
she
wasn't then anymore.
No.
Muzzled.
No.
She couldn't do this.
Right.
Please don't do
right.
Much.
Well, this is the way it, after 20 years, it had sort of become. And so I was trying to find. So
Can you give us some insight into Speak and Silence?
Well, first of all, originally, it was two solos.
Mm-hmm.
I was the time to be speaking and the time to be silent, singing, Lavinia Nielsen, my wife.
Uh-huh.
And while we were working on the piece, for some reason, other Jose maybe did, I have...
Oh. We better put this back in here and we won't hear a word you say.
Jesus.
There it goes. Oh, I'm getting it in the wrong hook. Okay.
To begin with, when he got the music, there was really no music for that particular session.
Mm-hmm.
And then he decided it better be in silence, and he got the idea of the clapping. And then it was too long to do two solos in silence, so we combined that. We did it also in one night, very late, and I remember because that particular rehearsal, what is the French mime, Marcel Marceau, he was sitting and watching, he had asked to watch the rehearsal.
Wow.
And that all that night, we were sweating and tearing things apart, he was sitting there. And so that's indeed what it is. I was angry. I was very angry.
It is angry.
I got to speak, I got to talk, you got to listen to me and all that. And she said, you know, and she put a hand in my mouth.
Uh-huh,
and
said, right.
You know, let us be silent.
Uh-huh, but it's on your part, your anger, you want to speak.
Oh, there's a uh-huh. rage in me, a rage.
You got to listen,
we cannot let this go on that, whatever, you know.
Uh-huh.
I made up my own story.
Uh-huh. Well, in the woman, the veil over the head, those long things, do they have any meaning?
No. Pauline Limon, Jose's wife, who did all the costumes, got that. I don't know. See, I don't know when that came,
mm-hmm.
but I know that are these pulls, which I
right,
think
that's
a sliding sort of medieval sort of parallel sort of feeling
uh-huh.
to that. I don't know. It was just that.
Yeah, does it have anything to do with shutting out the sound?
No, I didn't think so.
No, I didn't think so. I heard that somewhere,
no,
but I didn't think that
so.
Was it. Uh-huh. Yeah, it's one of the very exciting dances. And, well, there is a time it's beautiful all the way through, but that is one that really has audience appeal.
Yeah, it always got a big hand.
Yeah.
Because that, you know, it's rhythm is exciting.
Uh-huh.
And
well,
that sound. Yeah.
I don't know, the clapping, the rest of the dancers are off stage in the wings and they're clapping
yeah.
and keeping up that rhythm.
Yeah.
And at the end of the piece, I mean, you go through a 40-minute dance work and all through there's no applause between the pieces as in a dance.
Well, sometimes
after that one,
yeah, oh,
people
yeah.
stop all that
yeah.
silence and
yeah.
applaud.
Conor sometimes has time to laugh.
Oh, yes.
And Nina also.
Right, right, yeah, yeah. Now, Lucas, today you are in San Francisco, and what are you doing out there? When I was out there last year, I saw you, every time I turned around, your name was on posters, either your choreography or you performing.
I've been there about 4 or 5 years, and I've done a lot there, and there was a year that I did very, very many performances.
Uh-huh.
I had a performance group, and we performed a lot. Well, 12 women and 6 men for a modern dance group without money,
wow.
That's quite something, right?
Yes.
Well, it was quite something to keep that together. But it's exciting to people to see that much energy on a stage.
Yes.
And I did. I wanted it for myself. I had not choreographed for that many people. The aim of that was, the main thing I run there is what we call a dance lab, which is for young choreographers, beginning, young can
mm-hmm.
be 50 if that's beginning, then
right.
young
yeah.
as choreographers. And I discovered now what we talked about before, these people didn't know what a stage was.
Yes.
You know, we
right.
talked about that before.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, okay, I'll better get them on the stage, and from one piece it went to the next. You know, we did a benefit, and then I said, do another benefit. Before we know it, we had a small repertoire. And I think, liked that feeling of all that energy,
yeah.
particularly always in small, real small theater studios,
right.
you know.
Yeah.
So that energy works very strong, people are right there. And that, I think that was part of the... kind of attraction, but it was really too hard to run that with 18 people without pay.
Yeah.
And we, but it worked in so far. Certain people learned what it means to be a performer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I feel that's part of the craft,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Because a lot of us modern choreographers, we dance in our own pieces or, you know, and if you're as a choreographer, you're also supposed to be a director, right?
Right.
You have to shade and you know, nuances and all that. Well, these things, I feel very strongly that if you don't know what a stage is, how can you make things for a stage,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And a lot of kids don't know that.
Uh-huh.
But then a lot of people don't, nowadays seem to care very much.
Well, if you go through all this, I think people think they want to dance for themselves and you dance for someone else.
Well, yes, that's what we feel. But some certain people just want to be dancing and dance, and they
right.
don't really care.
Yeah.
I mean, they love it. If, yeah. You know, it closes.
Right, right.
And then, you know, that's the whole thing. And then some people think it is a way now that we have the superstars and all in our dance.
Lucas.
Is that it?
We're out of time.
Okay,
You've
right.
been a wonderful guest, and there's so much we could keep on talking about. I'm glad we finally got you from Bennington to San Francisco to here to New York.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's just wonderful, and I want you to keep on dancing on. You're teaching right now at the Jose Ramon Studio here, right down the street.
And I'm back. It's 2:41 and 35 seconds out there. This is CKUT. The show is Movement Museum. CKUT is on 90.3 FM on your radio dial, 91.7 on your cable dial. And you can access this show anytime you want, anywhere you want, on your computer, on your mobile device, on just about anything at movement-museum.blogspot.com. Yeah, that was just an interview with Lucas Hoving, who was an original member of the Jose Limon Dance Company. It was done by Billy Mahoney from her TV show called Dance On, which was on cable TV in New York in the 80s and 90s. We have coming up the Lourdes Lopez interview, which is from Dance Pulp, which is not from 1986, because I'm not entirely certain that Lourdes Lopez was born in 1986, because she's much younger than Lucas Hoving, who died back in 2000. But it's a much more, I would imagine it was an interview that was done probably over the summer. But before that, we have a rather busy this week in dance history. There's a bunch of stuff. First, to get the out-of-towners out of the way. Gelsley Kirkland, who was a dancer with the New York City Ballet, was 58 years old yesterday. Russ Tamblyn, who was Riff in West Side Story, is 76 years old today. And then Jose Greco died 10 years ago today as well. Maurice Béjart would have been 84 years of, he would have celebrated his 84th birthday on Saturday. And then it's quite busy as well on the local scene as well. On Monday, Eddie Toussaint turned 65 years old. On Friday, Harold Rayom turns 46 years old. And Fernand No, who would have been 90 years old on Monday as well. So yeah, we got a whole whack of stuff happening there. And in the background, you got the Henry Threadgill Zoid. This brings us to, which is volume 2 or volume 11. I'm not entirely certain. It is difficult to ascertain. But yes, without further ado, here is the interview with Lourdes Lopez.
I'm Lourdes Lopez. I'm the executive director of Morphosis, the Wielden Company. A big highlight in my dancing career probably would have been when I was promoted to soloist, because I never really thought that I would get into New York City Ballet. I just thought that I just wasn't the type to get in. And once I got in there into the core, there's this real sense that that's where most people stay. And I never quite felt like a real Balanchine dancer for some reason. So for him to have promoted me to a soloist, to me it meant that there was really hope that I could actually at one point become a principal. So I think when I look back, I think that day was one of the most personally fulfilling days for me. And there's an interesting, I always remember when I went up to him to thank him, it was during the Nutcracker season, I went up to him backstage, it was after performance, and I said, I just found out that I was promoted and I want to thank you, and I'd never, you do the usual, I never thought I would get it, and all of this. And he looked at me and he said, dear, I didn't do the work you did, so don't congratulate me. And that to me was incredible, because he moved the gift of the promotion that came from him, he gave it back to me. He kind of empowered the dancer to realize that you're being promoted because you've put a lot of work into this art form, period, end of story, not because of. And I just thought it was an interesting comment from him, because most of the time you get the director say, you're welcome, I'm so happy for you, it'll be fun. You never ever hear anybody saying, why are you thanking me? You did the work, I didn't. Was he possessive about dance, about ballet? Yes, he was. To him, it really was an incredibly spiritual man and a mystical man. And I think he viewed ballet and dance as a religion. So you didn't walk on the stage in your shoes. You didn't throw the costumes on the floor. You were respectful to the musicians, the wardrobe mistresses, to everybody that allowed you to dance that night, you were respectful to. And he was the first one that said that. Was he possessive about his dancers? When I got in, it was towards the end of his life. It was like the last 14 years of his life. So I didn't quite see that much, but I understood how he could be, because he felt this was his family. He was possessive, I think, like a parent was possessive. And I think for him it worked, because it wasn't you have to wear this and act this and you had. It was keeping you on track to make sure that you were moving in the direction that you wanted to move into. I think that was his possessiveness. The other great thing about him is that there was no ego. I mean, even with Mr. Balanchine, you walked into that theater and you left your ego behind, because it wasn't about you, it wasn't about him. It was about this art form, and you had to have that kind of dedication and focus to it. Or else why do it? I think Balanchine understood that no matter how talented he was, when the curtain went up, if there wasn't a dancer dancing his choreography, or somebody else's choreography for that matter, there's no reason. I mean, Balanchine's choreography lived in his head. Robin's choreography lived in his head. Christopher's choreography lives in his head. They need the instrument to make it happen. And I think that's why Balanchine ultimately was really so respectful of dancers, and he really was, he absolutely really was, because he understood he was just defeating himself by yelling and screaming and being a jerk. He didn't benefit from it. There was no benefit to that. And then I think also he was a gentleman, and like I said, I saw him get mad at a dancer because she put her costume on the floor, and he took her by the hand, went downstairs and said, do you see these women with glasses on hunching over sewing machines? They're here every day to make you look pretty at night. And it was those kind of messages that you realize that it was all a community, that you couldn't function without him, and he couldn't function without you, and neither one could function without the seamstress, and you couldn't function without the musician and the state. And it was all this one kind of community, and I think that has, for some reason, maybe changed a little bit. We don't quite understand it as well. Maybe because we move around so much, I don't know. The biggest differences between when I was there and today, I think that when the dancers that were there for a reason when I was there. And we were there to dance, and we were there for Balanchine. And you saw very little turnover, hardly any turnover in terms of dancers, because you were at the forefront of something happening, and you couldn't go anywhere that was really any better. And I'm not so sure that that's really understood at this point, with City Ballet, once you lose that founding father, The organizations do need to change, and they do need to kind of morph into something else. Not necessarily that it's better or worse, but they just have to morph and change into another organization or another institution. When I was there at City Ballet, it had some bureaucracy, but it was not an institution. It was still an arts organization. I think there's been a whole cultural change. You know, in other words, my generation versus your generation, very different human beings, very different information. My information was from a library. Your information is at the, you know, in a nanosecond, you can get any information you want. So there's a whole, the world has opened up. The world for you has become smaller. And the world for me, when I was growing up, was larger. So it's hard to fit those dancers into the past and today's dancers, or the past dancers into the future. I think dance is going through a very interesting, I think classical ballet is going through a very interesting change in terms of its dancers and its companies. I think dancers are becoming more mobile. I think they're not married or imprisoned to the idea that you have to stay somewhere for 20 years and make it work. I think they're open to opportunities. They say, look, you know, I 5 years, I'm not going anywhere. I'm going to try something else. And I think that's fabulous, because that doesn't mean that you don't love the art form. You can still come and watch performances. You can still become a physical therapist. You can still design. You can still contribute to the art form. You don't necessarily have to do it on stage. And that kind of information now, I think, has made the dancer different. You know what I'm saying? One of the reasons that I stopped is because I was offered this kind of summer position with Channel 4 WNBC in New York to cover the first Lincoln Center Arts Festival. And it was kind of at the time when I really wanted to stop already. I'd done 24 years and I had already been thinking that I wanted to move on to something else. And so I grabbed it. I said, I'm going to do this and I'll do it for 8 weeks and then I'll just see where I am. And I sort of, kind of, maybe not really enjoyed it, but it was an escape for me. It was a chance to get out. So I took it, and I did that for 2 years. I freelanced with them, and I really just hated it. And it wasn't that I had to dance. It was just knew that it wasn't the right place for me. And then I went on to teach quite a bit and kind of help put this school together and put a syllabus for them to kind of move from a semi-professional to a professional school, and I did that for a few years. And then Barbara Horgan, which was Mr. Balanchine's right hand, like personal administrator, asked me to head the Balanchine Foundation. And at that point, I didn't have an idea what that meant. And I said to her, well, at first I said no, then I said yes, and then I said no, then I said yes, and then I said I'll only do it if I can spend the summer there, kind of understanding what, because I don't, you know, I have no idea what that meant. I had some information about the non-for-profit world, but so I did that for a summer, and I thought, you know, let me just, it was such a small foundation, it was only two people, and very few projects, that it was really this perfect kind of, you know, on-the-job training. So I did that for about 3 years, 3 or 4 years, through the Balanchine Centennial. And then I had, then I kind of wanted to stop, but there were a lot of personal issues with my parents and things, and I had to travel home a lot because they were ill, and I just couldn't quite keep the two things going, so I left that. I remember there was a message that came from Alicia Alonso, the Cuban ballerina, and I think she kind of views me as her daughter because I'm Cuban and I dance. And she sent me a message through a friend of mine saying, you know, you've got to go back to dance. You've got to contribute to the art form, what it gave to you. And she was absolutely right. She goes, the art form needs it, which is why I believe that, you know, when you stop dancing, you should give back to it in, whether it's teaching or rehearsing or putting, you know, computer programs for it or whatever it is, but to be around it again and to contribute to it. And that's really what made me think, gee, you know, maybe I should kind of start to think this way, you know, be open to possibilities coming my way. And literally, it was a few months later that Chris called me from London and said, I have this idea. And, you know, he'd been kind of talking about it for a while. And we sat down. I said, well, let's just do it. I started dancing when I was 5 and a half because I had some orthopedic issues. I was pigeon-toed and flat-footed and didn't have calf muscles, and that was in Miami. And by the age of 8, orthopedic shoes came off, and I remember my parents saying, well, we can't really afford these classes, do you want to keep going? I said yes. So they put me with a Russian teacher named Alexander Nigadov, who actually taught me that these steps had names to them, and these ballets existed, 4 and 3 acts, Swan Lake, Sleeping Beauty, and all of a sudden taught me the history of dance, and I think it caught on, I got the bug. At the age of 10, I went to New York, and I was given a scholarship with Joffrey, and I studied there for that summer. And then the following summer, got a scholarship with the School of American Ballet, and would go to New York every summer until the age of 14, when they asked me to stay. I then moved to New York at 14 with my sister, who was 19, and we lived by ourselves. And I studied at School of American Ballet for about a year and a half, and at 15 and a half, got into the company as an apprentice, and then at 16, as a full fledged company member with New York City Ballet. And here I am. my orthopedic issues, I don't really remember them, whether they were an obstacle. You know, at five, you're not focused on that. It didn't mean, all I knew is I was wearing orthopedic shoes, but I never thought that I would be a professional dancer. I was never thinking, oh, because I have this, I won't ever dance. In fact, I don't think I ever understood that I could actually make a career out of dance until I was about 14. I, you know, grew up in Miami, Florida, and we would watch these dancers come in every, you know, once a year, I think, or twice a year as international ballet artists, and they would do, you know, sort of like a mixed program of pas de deux. But I never quite understood that there were specific companies and that you could actually get paid and you had benefits and there was a theater, and, you know, that just didn't enter my mind until much later. I really think that my generation was incredibly lucky because we worked with George Balanchine and Jerome Robbins, and really at that point they were the two geniuses of 20th century classical dance. I mean, there were other geniuses like Martha Graham and Merce Cunningham, but in terms of the classical vocabulary, those were the two that were really the most. And my career spanned 24 years with New York City Ballet, so I was able to work with both and be created by both those choreographers. And it was interesting because they were very, very different individuals. They basically got the same result from a dancer, but in very, very different ways. Jerome Robbins was a taskmaster and not always very nice, you know, not that he was brutal, but there was a tension in rehearsals and in these dress rehearsals, and he did it all because he just wanted, when that curtain came up, for you to be as, you know, the best that you could possibly be. And he was exact. You needed to move like he said, and an arm had to be exactly how he wanted it, and the step had to be exactly on the timing that he wanted it. And Balanchine, Mr. B, was just the complete opposite. You know, he was just incredibly respectful and nice, and if you couldn't do the step, he'd happily change it for you. And it wasn't, he really wanted the artist to come out, so he gave you a foundation or a guidelines, which were the choreography and the steps, and then he just wanted to see what you did with it. I mean, that's what was exciting to him. Balanchine and Robbins are called the geniuses of 20th century ballet, but the foundation is the classical vocabulary. In other words, they use the classical training, they use the point shoe, but they clearly were pushing it into the 21st century. Rather, they took 19th century dance and made it into 20th century. And now what needs to happen is that 20th century dance, which is Robbins and Balanchine and, you know, who else, Elliot Feld and Twyla Tharp and Bill Forsyth someone has to now move dance into the 21st century, still using the classical foundation, which is just the classical training. And I think I'm basically talking about the point shoe and the ability to turn out and you know, the line, the aspects of a line when a dancer is on stage. And that's what I mean by classical. The progression, I think, has I call it flatlined a little bit, because there was so much innovation going on in the 1940s and actually the 1950s and 60s in terms of dance, whether it was modern or classical. And we've reached a point, I think, I've seen it, where it's kind of status quo, where the dance world, the ballet companies, the classical ballet companies are kind of working in a bubble by themselves in a theater, then the modern dance companies are working in another bubble, and there's no interaction of ideas or energy or support or collaboration. It's become very separated and segregated, basically. So, you know, how do you change that? If you're a ballet company, you look outside of your world and you get a visual artist who is a contemporary visual artist, or you get a designer who designs costumes for theater, or you get, so you just kind of, it's more like the melting pot theory. You know, the more different aspects that you add to it, the more exciting the product, the stronger the product is. That's going to come out of it. And I just think also for artists, the minute you're in a bubble, you're dead. That's how you get your inspiration from watching other people, from information from other people. I mean, it's all about information. It's interesting because I think New York City Ballet was, because it was run or headed by a genius, even though it was all his choreography, and I don't think I'm biased when I say this, no two Balanchine ballets are alike. You can't compare Agon to Serenade, and you can't compare Serenade to Apollo. And so with him as the main choreographer somehow feeding these dancers and feeding, we didn't lack for creativity. And, you know, Balanchine came from an era in terms of the Ballet Russe, that he really did work with Picasso and Chagall and Stravinsky and Prokofiev. So he understood that. And he, you know, what was interesting about Balanchine is that a lot of the music that he chose was music that was never choreographed, it wasn't Chopin and it wasn't Delibes, and I mean, though he has some of those ballets to those composers, but he, you know, it's Hindemith and Webern and Stravinsky, and, you know, he really looked outside the norm, and I think that's another kind of creative collaboration. With Robbins, what he brought to New York City Ballet is the fact that he was on Broadway, and so he had a whole nother idea and scope of how to move and of American dance, and try to bring in Bernstein and Copeland and choreograph to that music. So those years there wasn't that much outside collaboration. You know, we didn't have visual artists coming in and designers, but the choreographers themselves were innovative and looking outside their world. I think technology is going to be a huge aspect outside for dance. I think number one, you're going to be seeing video and film used a lot more during performances of dance, though one has to be careful because the two of them can really visually compete in terms of the audience and where the focus is. But I think it's moving into a direction where people want to experiment, and I think that's important. Whether it's right or wrong, the idea is just to take the chance and do it. I think in terms of video, my personal belief is that dance is an art form that's handed down. And while I can download a dance, you know, from YouTube and learn it in a studio, there is nothing like having the actual person in front of you, because you have to realize the art form is having people watch you. A musician can kind of tape something or record something and then listen to it and see where he's made the mistakes. A dancer can't quite do that. So I think in terms of teaching, it's not going to help that much, but I think in terms of the actual performances on the stage, I think it'll be a very exciting addition to dance, video and film.
Johnny Black and Positive Vibes are coming up. My name's Zeke. This has been Movement Museum, talking about dance in Montreal and elsewhere on your radio. It's on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on your cable dial, and movement-museum.blogspot.com on everything else. Thanks a lot, and I'll speak to you all next year.